Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
You know, I've heard you say, the key to happiness is generosity. And you've also said in other speeches that chances are you won't be good at something you hate doing. You have to be good at something you love doing. How does someone find, whether they're young or middle age or older, how do they find what they love doing or what can make them happy?
It's rare that somebody will, at a young age, say, this is what I want to do in life, and it works out. That's rare. It takes a while to experiment. I thought I wanted to go in government. I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. I thought about politics. In the end, I found that what is making me happy is building something from scratch with the help of others, getting the material rewards from that and the giving those material rewards to other people. I tell people, I've made two college commencement speeches just in the last couple of days, and I told the students at Indiana University and University of Baltimore, experiment. You won't know right away. Try different things. Your parents are wonderful, but ignore what they want. My mother wanted me to be a dentist, well-meaning, but I didn't really want to do that. You can't let your parents live your life for you. So try many different things. I didn't start Carl until I was 37. Maybe people are can start things and find what they love earlier. I found out later in life. And now, because I found out later in life, and particularly now because I'm involved in my philanthropy phase, I'm doing what I call sprinting to the finish line. I'm now 69 years old, the age that Ronald Reagan was when he ran against Carter. When I thought 69 was old age and ready for a nursing home, now I think it's the prime of life. But I recognize that at 69, I've lived more than I'm going to live and probably have lived at least 3/4 of my actuarial expected life. So I'm trying to get as many things done in the remaining 25% or whatever it might be, because I don't want to be on my deathbed saying, oh, if I'd only done that, or why didn't I do that? I just don't want to do that. I want to get things done now, and that's why I'm working harder now and longer hours than I did when I was in my 20s. Okay.
Are we rolling on that?
Ready?
So yeah, we're already rolling. So I'm going to introduce you in a second, but you've one of the things I thought was fascinating about you was you've bought all of these incredible historical documents and then donated them to museums and government museums and so on. So like the Magna Carta, one of the copies of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Emancipation Proclamation, the 13th Amendment. It seems like you have this fascinating, and then you just mentioned how you're doing a book on, based on your interviews with historians, you have this great fascination with the literal building blocks of kind of the culture and civilization we live in. I'm just curious, people could always make their choices about where their philanthropy goes, and this is such an interesting thing that you've done, buying all these historical documents.
It's kind of interesting in this sense. Interesting, not so much that I've done it, others have done it as well, but that it gets so much attention because, relatively speaking, it's a modest part of the money I give away, but it gets the most visibility. And I am amazed that you can buy the Magna Carta for $21 million. You can buy a modern work of art for $200 million. And why a Magna Carta, the only copy in private hands, is worth $21 million, and why some modern work of art is worth $200, sometimes I can't understand, but that's the way the world operates. The reason I have done it is this. I stumbled into it. It wasn't a situation where I said, how can I do something useful for the country? Let me hire McKinsey. Let me come up with a great thing that I could do with some of my money. I stumbled into it because I went to a viewing of the Magna Carta at Sotheby's. They told me it was actually going to be auctioned off. I said, how can you auction off the Magna Carta? It turns out there are 17 copies of them, 15 in British institutions, one in the Australian Parliament, and one that Ross Perot had bought in the early 1980s from a family that had it in his possession for 500 years. He decided to auction it off about 10 years ago now, and I bought it, and then I put it on permanent display at the U.S. Archives, National Archives, and upon my death, it'll, you know, stay there. And so after that happened, I realized that people thought it was a good thing to make available these documents that many cases people have in their private collections, but just nobody sees them. So I started buying other historic documents, putting them on display, the ones you mentioned among others. But what's the importance of it? What's the relevance of it? So why is that such a great thing? If I told you I have a copy of the Magna Carta, a copy of it, it's a facsimile, it's on paper, and it's in the other room, you'd say, well, okay, I can look it up in a textbook anytime. I can look at it on a computer screen. It turns out that the human brain is still not so changed from the way it was 100 years ago or 200 years ago that people still want to see the original of something. So if you can see the original of the Magna Carta, you'd say, well, let me do that. And if I'm going to see the original, maybe before I see it or after I see it, I'm going to go learn more about its background, learn more about the history of it. If I tell you on a computer screen, here's a copy of the Magna Carta, here's the text, you won't be as interested to maybe learn as much. So it turns out by having these historic documents in places where people can see them, they might learn a little bit more about American history. And I can talk more about why I think that's important. The essence of it is we don't know as much about history as we should. We don't teach it as much as we used to. We don't teach civics very much. And you get statistics like 3/4 of the Americans say they cannot name the three branches of our government. And these are staggering kinds of things. And it's in large part because we don't teach civics as the way we did 25 years ago or 50 years ago. And American history, we barely teach now in even colleges. You can graduate from any college in this country practically without taking an American history course. And you can graduate as a history major in 80% of our colleges without having to take an American history course. It's just staggering to me. So I am interested in this maybe because I can understand it better than I can physics or chemistry or biology. I wasn't a superstar in those areas. So this is my little area that I know something about and care about.
And I mean, this is all on a tangent to all the things I wanted to talk about, but what do you see as, and I agree that understanding history is important, what do you see as the importance of understanding American history?
There was a Spanish-born philosopher, historian, political scientist, economist named George Santayana, who taught at Harvard for a while. And he famously said, those people that don't remember history are condemned to relive it. And many people have said similar versions of it, but that's the one that is often best remembered.
I like Mark Twain's, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes.
The same point. And so if you study history, you probably can learn what people did right or wrong before. So if you have a view that we've made mistakes, we should learn from them and maybe correct them in the future. So the reason I think it's important to learn history, and particularly the history of your country, is that, one, you can avoid the mistakes. Two, you have a better sense of what your country is all about. Three, you might be a more informed citizen, and therefore, my theory is if you have more informed citizens, you might have a better democracy. That's a hope.
So I'll do my attempt at an intro. Intros are always the hardest part for me, so forgive me if I get anything wrong. But David Rubenstein, you're a co-founder and co-chairman of the Carlyle Group, which is the biggest private equity firm maybe in the world, if I were to guess. It's over $200 billion in assets. You guys own hundreds of companies and invested in, I guess, hundreds more, if thousands of employees. And the companies you own, there's over a million employees. You're chairman of the Kennedy Institution of the Arts. Am I saying the name right?
John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts.
John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. You're chairman of the Smithsonian. There's many other titles. I could spend the entire hour introducing you, but you also have the David Rubenstein Show on Bloomberg, peer-to-peer conversations. And I have to say, I've watched quite a few of your shows. You're a great interviewer. And I got nervous before this interview. A, what do you ask the person who's been asked everything? And B, what do you ask the person who has also asked other people everything? So I've really admired your show.
And what did you conclude?
We'll find out by the end of this interview.
All right.
Actually, there's one thing I was curious about. When you were interviewing Barry Diller, you asked something to the effect of, how do you get to go from the mailroom to the CEO? Because right. You always hear about, it's like almost this mythology, great billionaires. Oh, I started in the mailroom. It's Barry Diller, Mike Ovitz, Brian Grazer, all these famous, entertainment billionaires started in the mailroom somewhere at CAA or William Morris or wherever. What would you do if you were starting in the mailroom at a private equity firm today?
I always wondered myself, and that's why I asked Barry Diller, what is it that about the mailroom that enables people to rise up? David Geffen, I think, being another one that did that. I think it was, in their case, that you get to see all the correspondence, and then you know who's doing what, and you get to make some contacts. And so if you're delivering the mail to a famous agent, you might talk to him about this or that you read about, and perhaps some of the contacts wear off on you. But it takes a little bit of gumption to kind of go from the mailroom to being Barry Diller. Now, presumably, everybody that worked in the mailroom didn't turn out to be a billionaire. Many of them still in the mailroom. If I was in the mailroom at Carlyle, I'd say, we have a problem because I don't think there should be a mailroom early in the sense that everything is electronic today. But there are some mail, of course, that's distributed. I don't think it would probably help as much. I haven't heard of many people starting private equity firms after they were in the mailroom of private equity firms, but that's probably because it's a different type of business. It tends to require a certain level of education generally, and maybe it's not as oriented to some relationships as maybe just the entertainment world might be.
But I like Barry Diller's answer also, which is that he said other people use it to, network with agents and other people, but he used it as an opportunity to basically read the history, the deep history of the firm and in the industry. So then he knows when he's talking to the agents, every project they're working on, their history, their background, and so he could start to come up with ideas for them. That's my guess is where he was going.
Another way of saying it is this. If you could read 10 people's correspondence every day for a year, you're going to know a lot about those people, maybe more than they want you to know. But there's no doubt that if you can read somebody's correspondence repeatedly, you're going to learn a lot, and it'll rub off on you and maybe make you more sophisticated, and you're able to open doors for yourself.
And you mentioned that education is obviously very important for private equity, but I don't think you really meant to discount relationships, because I would think one of the most important things when looking, so private equity, you basically look at a business that might be failing or have some problems. You invest at what you feel is a cheaper valuation than they should be if their problems were fixed. You fix those problems and eventually the company grows up and you sell them. That's a rough version of my definition.
Yes, but let me clarify what I meant. In the entertainment world, Bo Goldman, who famously wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and he passed away recently. He was the scriptwriter for that. He wrote a book that was entitled Nobody Here Knows Anything, I think it's something to that effect. And his point was is a lot of luck going on in Hollywood. Nobody can guess whether something's going to make it or not, and relationships matter a great deal. Academic pedigrees don't mean as much. If somebody writes a movie and it turns out to be great, whether he or she went to Harvard makes no difference. In the private equity world, because it's part of the finance world, and it's based to some extent in New York or Boston or large cities which have great universities, very often the people that go into these fields tend to go to very good colleges, very good business schools, and probably there's a greater premium in this part of the world, the finance world, than there is in the entertainment world and where you went to college or graduate school. The entertainment world, people don't care. If your movie is a bestseller, they don't care where you went to school. It makes no difference.
Yeah, and I guess with relationships in Hollywood, you could come up with a movie idea, but you get the meeting when you get, I don't know, Leonardo DiCaprio attached to the movie in some way. So that could be relationships. Like, you were just at his house. He says, yeah, sure, I'll do this movie. Then you can get into all the studios with a meeting. But I imagine your ability to evaluate people and evaluate the strength of the relationships with their partners helps you decide whether to go into a company and what your first steps would be in that company.
Well, of course, relationships matter in all businesses. I just think that my point was, in private equity and finance and some other areas, academic credentials from an academic institution probably mean more than they might meet in Hollywood. You can rise up in the mailroom more readily in the entertainment world probably than you could in private equity, but there are exceptions. There are people that have dropped out of college and made a lot of money in finance. Some of the best investment bankers ever never went to business school. So there's obviously exceptions. And relationships matter in all parts of life. You can't know too many people, and you can't cultivate too many good relationships. In the end, I was able to start Carlyle because of relationships that I developed, where people helped me get the initial money, helped me meet people who would join the firm. So of course, relationships matter everywhere.
So you started Carlyle in the late-ish 80s. And before that, you worked in the Carter White House. Before that, you were chief counsel for, I was surprised to read, the Senator Birch Bayh in Indiana. Can I tell you one little story?
Sure.
In 1980, this was my 12th-year-old birthday, and my dad took me to Washington, D.C., and he let me just run around. And I basically wandered into Birch Bayh's office, and it was his birthday also. So, and his staff was about to give him a surprise party and a cake and everything. So it was just a fun experience. I enjoyed his birthday cake with him and his staff at that time in 19. You were gone from there at that time. You were in the Carter White House, but I thought he was a very good guy. He was very nice to me as a 12-year-old just wandering into his office.
People don't remember him as much as maybe they should. He was elected to the United States Senate at the age of 34 in 1962. He beat an incumbent named Homer Capehart. He wrote two constitutional amendments.
Plus the ERA, which never became...
Which didn't become part of it, but he that failed. But he did write the 25th Amendment, which we're talking about these days a lot, and the and the amendment that lowered the voting age from 21 to 18. Also, he helped to author Title IX of the Education Act. He was defeated in 1980 by Dan Quayle and then retired. His son later became a United States Senator, Evan Bayh. Very distinguished person. I thought he was certainly qualified to be president of the United States in 1976, but he didn't start in Iowa early enough. Jimmy Carter, my ultimate boss, did start in Iowa, spent 100 days in Iowa, and it made a big difference.
So you were around all of these incredibly charismatic people, like Jimmy Carter. Nobody knew him when he started running. Everybody thought it was a joke, this one-term governor from Georgia running for president. Of course, Birch Bayh defeating an incumbent and staying in office for so long. You know, Washington is filled with probably more charisma than intelligence, some would say. You've seen all these charismatic people, and you yourself, you built this huge firm, and, you know, you don't come across, I doubt you would describe yourself as the most charismatic person in the world, but you're certainly very charismatic. What do you think are elements of charisma as you were building, you know, and raising tens of millions of dollars for the Carlyle Group?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm charismatic.
I knew you wouldn't say.
I would say I'm charisma challenged. Charisma is a word that came into the American popular lexicon, I'd say, when John Kennedy became president. People saw a certain sex appeal, charisma we called it, that just defied what you had seen with, let's say, Eisenhower or Harry Truman, for example. And charisma is something that politicians like to have. It's a, you know, I would say, a kind of sex appeal. You can get people excited. People listen to what you have to say. I don't have that kind of personality. I wish I did. But these people who have those kind of personalities are often people who are student body presidents or big men on campus. I was not. I was a little man on campus. In fact, in my graduating class, I would have been voted probably the least likely to succeed. I wound up being the chairman of the board of my alma mater, Duke University, and I would have been voted at the time there the least likely person to probably be chairman. And I tell people, and particularly college audiences and so forth and students, the trick in life is not to win necessarily the first third of life, but to win the second and third third. If you win the first third of life and you are a Rhodes Scholar, you're president of the Harvard Law Review, you're Supreme Court clerk, you're student body president, people think you're great, and maybe you are, but then you can tend to coast on that. And if you coast on that, the second and third third, you'll be bypassed by people like me who have to struggle to get through the first third, and they learn how to struggle, and then they, in the second and third third, they're struggling teaches them how to succeed. So I like to remind people that winning the first third of life is nice, but not necessarily going to indicate who's going to be successful in the part of life that probably matters, the second and third third.
Well, but it seems like you did pretty well, or very well the first third, you know, went to good schools, ended up working in the White House. You know, you mentioned John F. Kennedy. You worked for a while for Ted Sorensen, his speechwriter, one of the greatest speechwriters of all time. So from him, you must have learned a little bit about what makes someone a leader. Where was your struggle in the first third? And without the self-deprecating, like Carter, yeah, and inflation.
I would say, you know, my athletic career peaked at 7 or 8. You know, when I was 6, I thought
like
I'd
all
be
good Jews.
Well, yeah, I thought I was 6 o'clock. At the age of six, I thought, okay, I could be a professional baseball player. My idol was Mickey Mantle, Willie Mays. Then at 7 or 8, my growth stunted, and at 9, I was short, and 10, I was too short. And then I realized, you know, if you're Jewish, you're not likely to be a Major League Baseball player unless you're Sandy Koufax and you're unusual. So I wasn't a great athlete, and I wasn't first in my class. I wasn't student body president. I wouldn't say the most beautiful girls in the city of Baltimore were flocking to go out on dates with me. So I would say I wasn't, a big success. I was a success only in the eyes of two people, my parents. I was their only child. So they thought I was successful, but I knew better.
But then that's still not through the first third. That's like right. The first sixth. Then where would you say the struggle was after that? Like, obviously you were educationally, you succeeded at having a great education, and I'm sure you did well everywhere. And then you had you basically chose a path in life and seemed to keep succeeding
people
at it.
Did much better, but I'll give you an example. I got a job in the White House, which happened by working the campaign. If you work in a campaign and it wins, you probably get a job in the White House. So I joined Jimmy Carter when he was 33 points ahead of Gerald Ford in 1976, and Carter won by 1 point. You could argue my contribution wasn't so great, but I was the deputy to the domestic policy advisor who knew Carter well, and I became his deputy. And I worked very hard for 4 years. I did virtually nothing but work in the White House. I loved it. But then we lost the election. So all of a sudden, somebody who's flying around on Air Force One, going to Marine One, going to Camp David, advising the President of the United States, is unemployable because nobody wanted to hire a young lawyer who really didn't know how to practice law to do something in Washington, D.C. So it probably took 6 months before somebody would hire me. So I would say, you know, I had to lie to my mother. I said, I have so many offers, I don't know which one to take. And she would say, well, take one of them. It's, you know, it's May already. It's June. I mean, you know, everybody else is working. But so I would say that was a struggle. And then
Were you scared at that point?
I wasn't. I wouldn't say scared. I would say that I was embarrassed that nobody probably wanted to hire me, even though I thought I'd go into a good college and go into law school. And, you know, I worked in the White House, and I wasn't terrible. But I realized in hindsight that I had no legal skills anybody wanted because I didn't really practice law that long. And secondly, influence peddling, which is often done in Washington, is good if you are close to people in power. Well, Reagan wasn't somebody that I knew, so it didn't really work out. In the end, perseverance, you know, worked. I mean, I just persevered. I just kept going forward, and I got lucky. I practiced law again, and that's the greatest thing that happened to me. Second time I practiced law, it was clear to me that I wasn't a really good lawyer. Lawyers have specialized in various things. They care about little details. They have a narrow area of expertise. And they learned that in the first 7 years out of law school, or 7, 8 years. Well, I was mostly in the White House then, so I didn't really have the legal skills that my peers had. But had I done so, I would have been a nice, Washington corporate lawyer. And by the time I was 65, I would have been eased out of my firm because they retire you now. Because I wasn't good at practicing law, I had to do something else. And I stumbled into private equity. I got in on the ground floor of an industry that was booming, and I got very lucky, and it worked out. But it was, you know, some struggle to get there, and it took a long time. And when we first started the firm, many people laughed at us because who's going to build a private equity firm in Washington, D.C.? It's a government city, and nobody took us seriously for many years.
So when you started the private equity firm, is it because you had companies in mind or a theory in mind that companies were being undervalued, and you thought, okay, I can persuade this vision to investors and then put that money to work into these companies? Or did you just think there's a hole missing, like a private equity firm in Washington, D.C. would do well because of the government contacts, and that was your vision? Like, what was the vision, the first vision you brought to potential investors?
Well, I can lie to you and tell you I had great foresight and realized that we had an opportunity to build something great in Washington, but that wouldn't be true. What really happened was I was practicing law, and I really wasn't that good a lawyer. I mean, well, people weren't calling me up because I didn't have any great skills. And I read about a man named Bill Simon, who'd been Secretary of the Treasury, and he had done something called a leverage buyout in the early 80s, where he bought Gibson greeting cards. He put in $1 million of his own money. He made roughly $80 million in 2.5 years. I read about that and said, that's better than practicing law, whatever a leverage buyout is. I didn't know what it was. So I went down the street to Bill Miller, who had been Secretary of the Treasury in the Carter years, and said, why don't you start a leverage buyout firm like Bill Simon did, your predecessor, and I'll help you with some legal work, even though I'm not that great a lawyer. He didn't seem impressed by that. But I decided maybe I could start the first private equity firm in Washington. If I got people actually knew something about finance, I could do maybe some legal work. And then what happened was I came up with an idea that would say, well, we understand companies more heavily affected by the federal government than the guys in New York. So if you invest with us, you might get the benefit of our knowledge of Washington. That was basically what our pitch was. And maybe there was something to it, but you know, obviously people in New York knew things about Washington-regulated companies as well. What really enabled Carlyle to grow were, I would say, three things. One, we had a healthy culture. All businesses that survive and do well have a good culture, not a bad culture. And we had a culture that we were building something. It was one where the partners were sharing the wealth. We were trying to get good people and give them a lot of leeway and a lot of the shares of the profits. So it was a healthy culture. Second, we had a good track record. If you have a healthy culture and a bad track record, that's not going to be good. So I was very fortunate to recruit people that had very good investment capabilities, as it turned out, and we had a very, very good track record. And third, we came up with an idea that changed the face of private equity. Now, I don't have a royalty that I'm collecting from other people for having changed the face of private equity, and nobody is patting me on the back, and there's no Nobel Prize for private equity that I'm aware of. But the idea, and it's something that you will say, is this such a great idea? This doesn't strike me as the same as discovering DNA or discovering penicillin, and it's not. But it simply was this. Private equity firms were very small firms. They were all mom and pops. When KKR did the famous RJR deal in 1989, they had about 7 investment professionals. Why were they so small? Because the partnership agreements that you had said you can only do one thing. If you raise a fund, you have to spend all your time investing that fund, which makes sense. So they were all very small little boutiques. I decided that what we would do is try to build a Vanguard, a T. Rowe Price, a Fidelity of private equity, which is to say have many different funds and not just have one buyout fund. So after we raised our first buyout fund, it was $100 million, I told my partners, you manage this and would let me go out and try to recruit people to run a second fund, let's say in venture capital, a third fund in real estate, a fourth fund in debt. And then I will go raise money for them and you guys oversee the investment. So we were building out a family of funds, take advantage of our brand name and to take advantage of our capability of recruiting pretty good people. So that's what we did. We built a brand name. So today, you've heard of other brand names, KKR, Blackstone, Apollo, TPG, Bain. They've all done what we might have pioneered, which is to build out a family of funds and then take advantage of our brand name and centralize the administrative, legal, tax, accounting kind of thing. So that's, as I look at your face, you were nonplussed by lack of brilliance of that idea.
No, not at all, because it
doesn't seem like it's the same as discovering DNA, but it, you know, it worked.
No, but the interesting thing is you're right. They were like KKR was so focused on just the leverage buyout. I don't think they started thinking about venture capital to like 1999. you know, 13 years later?
They had the view initially, and I think they're very talented people, and they built a very good firm, that, you know, we were a bit of a franchise. We were like a McDonald's. We're setting up a fund here, a fund there. And then I came up with the other idea of globalizing the business. Historically, private equity people in the United States did their deals in the United States. Europeans did it in Europe, Asians in Asia. I said, let's go hire Europeans, and we'll have a Carlyle Europe fund, and Asians a Carlyle Asia fund. Many people didn't think that would work because we were based in the United States. What do we know about Europe? What do we know about Asia? But we hired locals. That was our strategy. And that's a model that others have followed. Now, they don't give me credit for it, and I don't maybe deserve the credit for it, but it was something that we did pioneer.
So, it's interesting, too, because one of the ways you were able to really build up the brand of the Carlyle Group in the beginning was to hire very well-known people, particularly in, you know, people coming out of government. And again, you were branding yourself as, hey, we know government better than anyone else. So it made sense for you to hire these, you know, ex-presidents. You had everybody from, you know, James Baker to John Major, who was the former prime minister of the UK.
It's a double-edged sword. Let me explain. Mm-hmm. Yes, I would like to say we understood companies heavily affected by government better than other people. So we did a lot of aerospace defense deals initially. And you could argue that the Pentagon is the biggest customer and people who understand the Pentagon might help you. And we did bring in former Secretary of Defense Frank Carlucci. After Frank Carlucci, we brought in Jim Baker, Dick Darman, George Herbert Walker Bush as an advisor, Arthur Levitt, former chairman of the SEC, John Major, and a few others. Now, the truth is, the double-edged sword is this. If you bring in government people and they are back lobbying the government, that's not a good thing, because it looks like you're taking advantage of your ties, particularly these visible people, and they never did that. Their role was not so much to give us advice about the government. We had lower-level people that would deal with the kind of issues we had to deal with. Their real role was to give us some visibility. So if I called you up 20 years ago and said, guess what, I'm coming to London and I'm going to tell you about my private equity fund, would you like to have lunch with me? You'd say, well, who are you? I say, by the way, Jim Baker is coming with George Bush, and you might want to hear about what they did when they were government, and maybe at the end I'll tell you a little bit about my private equity fund. You might say, well, I'll roll my eyes about the private equity fund, but I want to hear Jim Baker and George Bush. So they were really draws for sessions we would have, and there's no doubt that they were very effective draws. As Carlyle's brand name became better known, we didn't need them to be the draws so much, and ultimately they retired from the firm, and we tried to avoid the perception that we've ever used government people in any inappropriate way, which is to go out and lobby government. They never did that. They were really very nice people. George Herbert Walker Bush became a very close friend of mine. I was at his memorial service. I was at Barbara Bush's memorial service. They were terrific people, some of the nicest people I ever met, but they never went back and talked to government for us. Their role was really to kind of give us some visibility and maybe credibility. If you hear George Walker, Herbert Walker Bush saying, Carlyle, Rubenstein, nice firm, you know, he's not an investment expert, you'd say, well, he thinks it's a nice firm, maybe we'll take a look at it. If the track record was terrible, it wouldn't make a difference, though.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, good things come to those who wait. I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle. Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Justin and so good. Thousands of summer deals at your Nordstrom Rack store. Save up to 60% on new arrivals from Vince, Rag & Bone, Adidas, Joe's, Marc Jacobs, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. But hurry for first dibs. Get your summer favorites up to 60% off at Nordstrom Rack today. Great brands, great prices. That's why you rack.
Again, we were talking about charisma earlier, and you said, oh, it's the type of person who gets people excited or was student body president or whatever. But let's change the word a little bit and call it persuasion. Obviously, you've been really good at persuading extremely important people to join your
right.
beginning firm. And yes, track record is important, but you built that over time. You're incredibly good at persuading people to invest in you. You're incredibly good at persuading companies. You know, private equity, the industry at times has been like a little bit of a battlefield. There were too many companies and too few private equity firms. Too many private equity firms, too few companies. Everyone was sort of auctioning for the best deal. How you had to be good at persuading people to take the investment from you, and then ultimately you had to persuade people to buy investments from you. And so what are your elements of persuasion that you think are important?
Well, let me correct one thing. You can never have too many private equity firms. The world can never have too many private equity firms. But to be serious—
I'm assuming that's a little bit of a joke.
That is tongue-in-cheek. Okay. Maybe you can occasionally have one or two more than you need. I don't know. There was a book written by Richard Neustadt called Presidential Power. It was written in the late 1950s. And he was the person that John Kennedy asked to head up or give him a paper on the transition when Kennedy was elected in 1960. In those days, transitions were different than today. There was no office for a transition. John Kennedy ran his transition out of his townhouse in Georgetown. There was no money for transitions. They were very different. And Richard Neustadt produced like one of the few memos that was written for the transition before the election occurred. In that book, which was a very influential book, he said the president only has the power to persuade. The power he has is relatively weak. Neustadt had worked in the Truman administration, and Truman was frustrated. He would say, do this, do that, and nothing would get done. It wasn't like the military. When you think about it, all of life is about the ability to persuade other people to do what you want. And the way I look at it is your partner, your spouse, your child, your parent. In life, what you're really trying to do is persuade somebody to do what you want. Even if you're Albert Einstein, you come up with E=mc². Nobody really was persuaded initially. He had to spend some time convincing people that he was right, and it took a long time. So there are three ways you can persuade people. One is—
Do you mind if I write down while you say these things?
Okay. There are three ways to persuade people. Number one is by writing. Obviously, people who are gifted writers can persuade people to follow them. Now, not everybody is William Shakespeare. So not everybody can write so eloquently. But if you learn how to write a memo, a letter, an article, a book, you can be very persuasive. Op-ed articles are persuasive to people, editorials, many things. Some people know how to do that. Some people do not. A second way is to learn how to talk in oral communication. Martin Luther King, you could argue, was a very persuasive orator. Presumably, other great orators had the same skill of really knowing how to persuade people, or great lawyers, David Boies, presumably able to persuade a judge or a jury. So learning how to talk in an effective way can be another way to persuade people. But the third way is the most effective way, and that's to persuade people by example. So, for example, when George Washington was fighting the Revolutionary War, he was the general, lieutenant general. He didn't have to mix with the troops that much because he was the general. He had provisions, he had clothing, he had food. But in Valley Forge in 1777, he stayed with the troops. A third of them didn't have enough clothes. Half of them didn't have really shoes. They were really in bad shape. He could have stayed. He could have said to them, look, there's a Ritz-Carlton down the street. I'm going to stay there, and when we go to war again, I'll come back and see you. Because in those days, bizarrely, when the winter came, people didn't fight. It was too cold to fight. So the British would hang out in Manhattan or Philadelphia, and Washington with his troops would be in the suburbs, and they didn't fight. There was like an unwritten rule. You don't fight in the wintertime. It's too cold or something. But he stayed with his troops. Lead by example. Communicate by example. So if you really want to persuade people to do something that you say you're going to do and have other people follow it. Now, this is what persuasion is, one of these ways, and you learn how to persuade people. And there's some people that know how to write so well, but they're demagogues, or they talk so well, they're demagogues, that they use it in an inappropriate way. And you can lead by example in an inappropriate way. But these are the three things that I think are very important. Now, if you're going to be a fundraiser, you raise money, you want people to invest with Carlyle or with other firms, you have to be able to provide written materials that are persuasive. You also have to be able to orally present and maybe lead by example by putting your own money alongside the investors. So that's the point.
Right. So I'm going to ask you first. I'm going to go backwards. So example, you have three kids. Where have you been able to... Kids, of course, you can't tell them anything and you can't write them a letter, do this. Where have you kind of been able to persuade them by leading by example?
Well, I would put it this way. I would say, I like to quote Jackie Kennedy, who famously said, if you mess up raising your children, nothing else in life really matters. And what she was really saying in a different way than I would say it is, the hardest thing in life is raising children and having them be happy, healthy, successful. It's just not easy. And we've seen over, you know, several million years, people who are prominent raise children who are not as successful, and then people who are not prominent raise kids who are very successful. There's no one way to raise kids that work. Clearly, if you're not wealthy and a wealthy person says raising children in a wealthy environment is difficult, they will be upset with you because you have all these advantages they don't have. But the truth is, if you look at wealthy families, they very often don't produce people who are as driven as the person who might have made the money. So if you get successful in life, you have to remember that you have to spend some time disciplining your children or persuading them or being a role model for them. If you just say, here's plenty of money and have a nice life, they probably aren't going to, you know, be as successful as you would like. So the people that run the world, by and large, with a few exceptions, generally came from blue-collar or lower-middle-class backgrounds.
So it's a general rule. What's a specific example where you taught your kids?
Well, my kids are pretty hardworking. You know, I wouldn't say they're obsessive-compulsive workaholics, as some people might say I am, but I tried by working hard give them an example that if they work hard, maybe something good will come from it. Secondly, I have greatly valued education, which was the pathway for me to get from where I was. So I've emphasized the importance of doing well in school to them and how important that is to me. Also, the importance of treating other people well and try to show them how you treat people appropriately, how you relate to them. And, you know, I'll let other people judge whether, I have been successful. But clearly, most people are proud of their children. I'm proud of my children, but I don't want them to all of a sudden think that because I have money that their life is going to be easy and they don't have to do anything.
Well, and I'm going to actually stick a pin in that because I'm going to get back to that. In terms of persuasion with writing and talking, there's similar principles to both with persuasion. You know, maybe you can address that. Like when you are going to speak to somebody and persuade them, and this maybe was more difficult when you were starting out, or when you're going to write a letter to somebody to persuade them, there's probably similar, they run in parallel. There's similar techniques of persuasion in both of those. And what would you say have worked for you?
Well, there are many techniques. There's no perfect way, but I'd say if you're going to have a conversation with somebody and you want to persuade them to do A, B, or C, it's pretty good to know something about this person before you have the meeting. So if you know this person hates A, B, and C, you need to find a way to persuade them. And if you know their views, it's helpful. So finding out something about somebody you meet is helpful. Secondly, it turns out that people like to feel connected with people. So if I say to you, I grew up in Baltimore, and you say, I grew up in Baltimore, all of a sudden we have a connection. If I say, I went to Duke, and you say, I went to Duke, we have a connection. Now,
I went to Duke.
Okay, well, we're connected.
I went 3 summers to their TIP program when I was in high school.
Well, that's a very good program. That's for children who are advanced at that age. They're very, very well run. It's a very good program. But if you have a connection with people, the trick is to find what the connection is. So you'll see in many conversations that people have all over the world and all kinds of things, that people try to say, hey, I went to school here, you went to school here, I did this, I do that, we're common, we play tennis, we do this. So try to figure out what the connections are. Then you can also see by letting people talk first what it is that is on their mind. If you're trying to persuade somebody to do something and you go in and say, I don't have time to listen to you, let me tell you why my ideas are so great, that person may say, well, geez, you know, I kind of have my own views, and I guess if you listen to my views, maybe you would have tilted your argument to align yourself with me. So listening to people, letting people talk. Remember, the most popular word in the English language is what? I. People love to talk about themselves. Let people talk about themselves. You'll learn something. Let them give you their ideas. So if you're trying to persuade people, learn something about them in advance, connect with them, find out what connections you have, let them tell you what's on their mind at that time, and then if you're trying to persuade them of something, you have a better chance. If you go into a meeting and don't know the person's background, don't know anything about the person's history, don't listen to the person, don't feel there's any point in developing a connection, you're likely to be less successful.
So let's say you learn about them and you know you're trying to convince them of A, B, and C, and you've learned that they probably hate A, B, and C.
Okay.
And
you learned in advance?
You learned in advance.
Okay.
And you have to write them a letter.
Okay.
What would you say in the letter?
I would say, I know that you hate A, B, and C, and frankly, I wasn't so sure I would like A, B, and C either. In fact, it took me a long time to learn that I would like A, B, and C. And by the way, learning about A, B, C, let me tell you the funny things that happened to me along the way of learning about A, B, and C, and let me tell you the mistakes I made. People like to hear how other people failed, stumbled. Self-deprecating humor works. I think humor, when you make fun of other people, usually doesn't work. So if I'm writing to somebody, I wouldn't say, by the way, you said something that was stupid, as opposed to saying, I said something that was stupid. So I think self-deprecating humor and humility works. Now, and today, it may seem strange to say to people, arrogance won't get you anywhere. Arrogance may get you somewhere. There's some examples of some people who are arrogant who like to brag that may have gotten someplace. But as a general rule of thumb,
I feel like that was humor because you were probably referring to something specific, but we won't go into it.
I don't know what you're referring to, but I would say as a general rule of thumb, people that can make fun of themselves get further in life. As a general rule of thumb, very secure people are humble. Warren Buffett, who I know, you know, reasonably well, modestly well, I wouldn't claim a buddy of his, but I've spent some time with him, interviewed him. He's, you know, pretty humble person, makes jokes about himself. I'd say other really accomplished people are people that are humble. People that are arrogant, I find probably are in the end generally not as successful. But sometimes there are exceptions to that. So I do think that self-deprecating humor can be very useful in a speech. If I'm making a speech, I think self-deprecating humor can be very useful because if you're starting a speech and you tell people funny things about yourself and how not you're not so great, and you're convincing about it. You can't say, you know, I made a mistake the other day, and I really was, it was dumb for me to do it, but generally I'm a genius. You can't step on your self-deprecating line. You have to give the self-deprecating line and let it stay there.
You have to own it. That you're
you
not
have to really
to...
believe it. I mean, some people I know try self-deprecating humor. It doesn't work. Now, John Kennedy was a very, very secure person, and he could get away with self-deprecating humor. And, you know, he may have, you know, thought he was better than maybe he would let on. Sometimes people who are insecure cannot make self-deprecating humor. Now, when I was younger and maybe less secure about myself, I didn't make fun of myself. Now I'm more accomplished, and so I'm pretty secure in what I've done and where I am, and I can afford to make fun of myself because, you know, it doesn't go to my persona anymore. I know that I've accomplished certain things, and I won't feel bad about myself if I say how bad I am because, you know, to some extent there's some humor in it.
So I'm curious about one other element of persuasion which you must deal with when looking at the hundreds of companies that you've either invested in or worked with and so on. Which is motivation. You look at a CEO, and part of a CEO's purpose is to execute and to monetize and so on, but they also have to motivate their customers, their shareholders, their employees, their vendors, and so on. What are some things you look for?
Is really, in many ways, the most important existential question about life. What motivates people? Why are people motivated to do what they do? There are 7.5 billion people on the face of the earth. What are they doing here? What's the point of it? What's the point of life? What motivates somebody to really want to work hard or not work hard or to do this or that? Nobody really knows where we came from, what we're doing, what life is all about. But we've generally adopted the view that living is better than not living, that working is better than not working, that trying to make the world a better place is better than trying to ruin the world, that interacting pleasantly with other people is better than not doing that. And as a general rule of thumb, people have decided that progress and some kind of measure of success is better than failure and no progress. So what motivates a CEO? Well, a CEO might be motivated because he has a family he wants to support. He wants to prove that he's a smart person or she's a smart person, want to prove that they know how to motivate their employees. In the end, money is a very big motivator for people in the business world. It's a measure of success to some extent. So, you know, you have to figure out what motivates a CEO. Generally, they want to be seen as successful by their peers, by their family, by their employees. And so that's, you know, you can figure out pretty readily what motivates some people if you spend some time talking to them.
So, and you think the best CEOs, of course, are good at motivating their employees.
Absolutely.
And so you think you look for, yes, they're motivated, but do they know how to motivate? How can you determine
that? Well, as I said, you have to persuade people. So you persuade them by giving good speeches to them, talking to them, writing to them, or leading by example, persuading by example. Those are the three basic ways that I would mention. And some people are good at it and some are not. Now, some people produce wonderful results as CEOs, but they're not particularly charismatic. Some produce terrible results, and they are very charismatic. So it depends. But generally, if you take a CEO like Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or Steve Jobs in their early years, they were on a mission to build a computer, to build straight software, to sell things over the internet, and they were able to convince the people working for them that there was some greater social purpose to doing that other than just making money for themselves. And that social purpose was giving people more knowledge, more capability of doing other things, getting things more cheaply, whatever it might be. And so you have to convince people that what you're doing is a useful thing. You can't say to people, let's make this widget, not because it's a good thing to do, but it just will make us money. And that's the only motivation. And you have no other feeling that it's something good socially about it. It probably won't work in the end.
You know, I've heard you say, you know, the key to happiness is generosity. And you've also said in other speeches that chances are you won't be good at something you hate doing. You have to be good at something you love doing. I think a big struggle many people have, particularly in today's day and age where people don't stay at the same job for 50 years often, they either reinvent themselves or someone gets divorced and moves and has to recreate themselves. How does someone find, whether they're young or middle age or older, how do they find what what they love doing or what can make them happy.
It's rare that somebody will, at a young age, say, this is what I want to do in life, and it works out. You know, maybe Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Mickey Mantle early on knew they wanted to be a baseball player, and it worked out for them, but that's rare. And of course, if you are in that fortunate situation, you have to figure out what you do with the rest of your life when your playing career is over. But it takes a while to experiment. I thought I wanted to go in government. I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. I thought about politics. In the end, I found that what is making me happy is building something from scratch with the help of others, getting the material rewards from that, and then giving those material rewards to other people and helping other people. So that's what motivates me. But everybody has their own motivation. But I tell people, I've made two college commencement speeches just in the last couple of days, and I told the students at Indiana University and University of Baltimore, experiment. You won't know right away. Try different things. Your parents are wonderful, but ignore what they want. My mother wanted me to be a dentist, well-meaning, but I didn't really want to do that. You can't let your parents live your life for you. So try many different things. I didn't start Carlisle until I was 37. Maybe people can start things and find what they love earlier. I found out later in life. And now, because I found out later in life, and particularly now because I'm involved in my philanthropy phase, I am doing what I call sprinting to the finish line. I'm now 69 years old, the age that Ronald Reagan was when he ran against Carter, when I thought 69 was old age and you ready for a nursing home. Now I think it's the prime of life. But I recognize that at 69, I've lived more than I'm going to live and probably have lived at least 3/4 of my actuarial expected life. So I'm trying to get as many things done in the remaining 25% or whatever it might be, because I don't want to be on my deathbed saying, oh, if I'd only done that, or why didn't I do that? I just don't want to do that. I want to get things done now, and that's why I'm working harder now and longer hours than I did when I was in my 20s.
And so experimenting also, I think, like I know you read a lot, you read over 100 books a year, you're involved in you sponsor the National Book Festival. Reading is often a good way to safely experiment without actually leaving your room.
When I was 6 years old, I got a library card at the Enoch Pratt Free Library in Baltimore, and it was a prized possession, and somebody actually recently gave me a copy of it. They had on the files, I guess. And you could take out 12 books a week, and I would take out the 12 books, and I'd read them all in one day. I had to wait another week before I could take out more books. I thought they should have changed the policy, but I didn't know how to persuade people in those days, so I couldn't do it. Reading has enabled me to go from a very cloistered upbringing in Baltimore to a more worldly knowledge. And to me, it's what really has helped me in life. So I think that reading books is better than reading tweets or other things, because you concentrate the brain. You have to spend hours and hours and hours doing it. So I do love reading, and I like to remind people, unfortunately, the 14% of Americans are functionally illiterate, so they can't read at all beyond a fourth grade level. And 30% of Americans are what I would call illiterate, which is to say they can read, but they choose not to. So 30%, and I say 30%, it's 30% of Americans who graduate from college never read another book in their life. Mm. Hard to believe, but it's a sad situation. So I try to tell every graduating class or people I speak to, read books. Keep reading. It exposes you to so many different parts of the world, and it's a great pleasure in life.
And on that note, I want to make sure, I know you're writing a book that we can all read, and I want to make sure you get to your meeting with your publisher. One final thing, which hopefully you can answer quickly. You're 69, you do all of these things. We've listed only maybe one-fifth of the things that you do incredibly. How do you have the energy? I feel tired by 11 a.m. every day.
Well, I could do a better job in some respects when I interviewed Jeff Bezos, he said the key to his success is getting 8 hours of sleep a night. And I realized that nobody in the audience was getting 8 hours of sleep a night, including me. So I expect I would be better if I got 8 hours of sleep a night. But I think what it is I'm fairly well motivated. I think motivation helps you. If you love what you're doing, it's not work. So everything I'm doing every day, including this discussion, is something I wanted to do. I don't have to do a lot of things I don't want to do anymore. So loving what you do, it makes it easier. Taking the time to really prepare for it and making certain that you know what you're doing helps. And I would like to quote Jim Baker's father, who used to say to him, prior preparation prevents poor performance. Prior preparation prevents poor performance. So I like to be prepared, and when I'm prepared, I feel, good about what I'm trying to do, even though it might seem taxing. So, for example, yesterday, for a program I have on WNET, public television with the New York Historical Society in New York, I had to interview, because of the schedule, Ron Chernow about his new book on Grant, without taking a break after that was over, go and then interview Walter Isaacson on all of his books, and then Cokie Roberts on all of her books. So in a 3-hour period, I had to, kind of go through many books, and I, was prepared for it, so I could do it. But if you're not prepared, it would be much more difficult. But I, I love what I'm doing. I just, I don't know. When you reach the age of 69, you don't know what is going to go bad. Is it something in the brain or something in the body? And never know. Something, I could walk out of here tomorrow and I get hit by a car. You never know what's going to happen, or some bad thing can happen. Why is it that somebody got cancer and I didn't? Why is it that somebody got had a heart attack and I didn't? You just don't know. So you just want to keep moving forward. Think that you're lucky if you can continue to live. And that's, what I'm trying to do, get as much done as I can before my brain goes or my body goes.
Well, David Rubenstein, co-chairman of Carlyle Group, chairman of a billion other things, co-founder of the Carlyle Group, chairman of the Smithsonian Institution, philanthropist, member of the Forbes billionaire list. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I want to mention Byron Allen, who owns the Weather Channel, asked me to convey to you his gratitude for your great donation to the National African American Museum. He was very grateful for that. And
thank him for keeping me informed about the weather.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks a lot.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive.
At participating McDonald's.